Thanks, Paddy. Well,
I wanted to start a talk about socialist alternative by talking about really what we're all about, which is, I'm giving an example of this, which is revolution, because that's what we are, revolutionaries. I want to quote a first-hand account of May 68 in Paris, in France, where thousands of, or hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people, in fact, took to the streets in support of their rights and challenging the very structure of French society. So I quote, give you a sense. The streets are crowded. The response to a call for a 24-hour general strike has exceeded the wildest hopes of the trade unions. There's not a car nor a bus in sight. The streets of Paris today belong to the demonstrators. Thousands of them are already in the square in front of the station, and thousands more are coming in from every direction. We're already packed like sardines for as far as the eye can see, yet there is still an hour to go before we're even due to begin. Demonstrators have climbed onto the walls, onto the roofs of bus stops, and onto the train station. And red flags are flying throughout the crowd. And in the Central University of Paris, in the Sorbonne, everything, literally everything, was suddenly and simultaneously up for discussion, for question and for challenge. Day and night, every lecture theatre was packed with students discussing everything that had ever preoccupied thinking humanity. Discussions were underway on sexual repression, on the colonial question, on ideology and mystification. Any group of people wishing to discuss anything would just take over a lecture theatre until they were finished. The first impression, he writes, was of a gigantic lid suddenly lifted, of pent-up thoughts and aspirations exploding, on being released from the realm of the dreams to the realm of the real and the possible. And I guess I wanted to start with this, because that's the kind of situation that we're fighting for here in Socialist Alternative. But I guess I want to explain the ideas, the politics behind this kind of situation of social revolution, the idea of being anti-capitalist, the idea of being pro-socialist, as Trevor Nguyen said, and the idea that the working class has both the power and the right to take over society. Because these are the kind of ideas that underpin our involvement. So Surprise Supplies, we're a socialist organisation, and we're socialists not in the European, wishy-washy, social democratic sense, and definitely not in the one-party, dictatorship, Stalinist sense, but in the real revolutionary meaning of the word. That is, we think that nothing under capitalism has the right to exist. Not the exploitation, not the class divisions, not the poverty, none of it. We're for a world run by ordinary people, by the working class, and by the oppressed today. And some view this sort of society or this idea, as a bit extreme, a bit far out, a bit radical. But really, there are some facts which I think of this world point to the fact that this world today is both extreme and radical in the most negative sense possible. The fact that the 7 richest people in the world own more assets than the bottom 41 nations combined. The fact that 30,000 people die each day of hunger and hunger-related causes when there's more than enough food to feed the world 1.5 times over. And the fact that it would take 0.02% of the military budget for 2008 to cure all basic education, sanitation, and nutritional requirements for every single person on this planet. 0.02%. This is nothing. This is the kind of world we live in. And this horror is not some accident. It's not some byproduct of the world. It's because the system is designed to enrich and strengthen the minority at the top who live off the exploitation of the majority and not to meet human need. Think about it. Why is it the case that drug companies are now curing things as complex as diabetes and HIV and cancer while there are people dying of dehydration and anemia? This is the kind of world we live in. And it's not just in the third world. In Sicko, Michael Moore documentary about America and the American healthcare system, he documents how people are dying of tooth infections because they can't actually afford to go to the dentist. Tooth infections become deadly in capitalist society in the 21st century. And the reason that these criminals aren't behind bars is because the people who own and operate these bars are actually part of the same class of these criminals. That is, people who run the state, the people who run the injustice system, all these people are part of the same ruling elite. So when drug companies in India, for example, begin producing medicines to treat some of the things the Indian people need, the US government intervenes by the World Trade Organization to reimpose copyright laws, intellectual property, to make sure the people who need these drugs can't access them. So this is the kind of world we live in today, and I think this is the kind of world that's extreme and needs to be gotten rid of. And really, apart from the tragedy and horror of these kind of stories, is the irrationality of it. You know, we have enough food, we have enough medicine, all this stuff exists, it's just not being distributed. And that's what socialism is about. It's about developing this technology and distributing it to, you know, from each according to their ability, to each according to their need. This is what we're all about. And some say this can be achieved bit by bit, gradually, through reforms and so on. It's an easier option, maybe less violent or whatever. But I think, you know, it's been 150 years since Marx wrote Capital, and it's pretty clear things aren't being reformed bit by bit. For example, the relative gap in rich and poor has grown every year since the 1970s. And that's why we stand for a revolution. The Labour Party today, the Social Democratic Parties of Europe, are a shadow of what they once were. That road has been tried and failed. We need a new one. But let's be honest, you know, revolution is not going to be easy, because while we're here organising, while the working class has time and time again organised and rose up to challenge the system, the ruling class is not just sitting back, you know, placing bets on whether or not we get it this time. They're actually making things harder for us. They pass bills like work choices, the anti-terror laws, to make our ability to unite more difficult. They promote divisive ideas like racism and sexism and so on, homophobia, to make it more difficult for us to actually unite and see our common enemy. And really, they've got institutional power. They've got the police. They've got the military. They've got the family. They've got the education system, all of which indoctrinates and enslaves us. So, and they don't even have to do it in their spare time is the worst part. You know, we have to volunteer our time this weekend. We have to work in the meantime, study. They get paid to do it. You know, they're CEOs. That's what they do. They murder people. They're politicians. That's what they do. They pass laws to help facilitate this murder. So in some sense, they have an immediate advantage, I guess. And, you know, they're structural power under capitalism. That's why it's capitalism, the rule of capital. But we have our own strengths, and I think that's what I want to talk about now. For example, in every developed nation, you know, the heart of the system, America, Australia, so on, workers make up 60 to 70% of the population, including their dependents. This is, you know, a numerical base from which we can work. But it's not just numerical superiority. It's about workers' central role in the economic process. It's by the fact that workers produced this room. They built this room. They built these chairs. They made this paper and so on. So if workers stop making these things, the entire system grinds to a halt. And that includes profits. And so it's not as if Rupert Murdoch could put out a newspaper, for example, or Julia Gillard could, you know, build a building or anything like this. So it's precisely because workers are exploited that workers are needed. And it's seeing this contradiction. From that contradiction arises all the power of the working class in society today. We can say no more. And because of this thing, despite this power, the structures of capitalism will not just go away by us saying no. Actually, feudalism required a revolution to be gotten rid of. The monarchs and, you know, kings would not, and queens would not just roll over. They had to be forcibly overthrown. And I think the same is true today. But far from being orgies of, you know, pitchforks and violence and mob violence as they're currently kind of construed, revolutions, working class revolutions, you know, in particular, I would say, are the most incredibly joyful, liberating experiences for the people involved. And it's really hard to convey this in a talk, but if you think back to the quote about May 68, you get a sense of it. Another example would be the Russian Revolution. If people have read John Reed's inspiring account of 10 Days That Shook the World, you can get a sense of the kind of universal class solidarity, the humanity that's being shown in this process, but also the depth of politicization of society. You know, in the sea of apathy we see today, reading about what happened in 1917 in this backward society can really give us a sense of what revolutions can do. So I want to quote, when the train backed into the station, a mob of shabby soldiers stormed the doors, smashed the windows, and poured into all the compartments, filling up the aisles and even climbing onto the roof. You can see, like, norms of spatial kind of propriety don't really exist in these kind of situations. This was a good-natured crowd, bearing the discomfort with humorous patience, interminably arguing about everything from the situation in Petrograd to the British trade union system. And before we reached Moscow, almost every car had organized a committee to secure the distribution of food, and every committee was already divided into political factions, wrangling over fundamental principles. And in May 68, some of the slogans that the students there adopted were things, you know, as wonderful as, "The most beautiful sculpture is a paving stone thrown at a cop's head." "Poetry is in the streets." And perhaps my favourite, "When the National Assembly, the French Parliament, becomes a bourgeois theatre, all the bourgeois theatres should become national assemblies." A slogan inscribed over the entrance of the biggest theatre in central Paris. So how do we, you know, social determinants propose that we go from where we are today to this kind of situation? Well, you know, as counterintuitive as it might seem, it's not the actions of, you know, revolutionaries, and like those of us in this room, who make revolutions. Actually, it's the contradictions inbuilt in the capitalist society. It's the fact that every now and again, whether we like it or not, or whether they like it or not, the system goes into deep crisis. Suddenly, from building things, from constructing things, from producing things, the system just finds that they can't do so anymore. Or, for example, there's a war. A massive war breaks out that fundamentally shakes society's foundations. And these things happen all too often under capitalism, the current crisis just being the latest kind of example of that. And so, you know, this fact, the fact that revolutions happen sort of endemically to capitalism, means that it's not us that need to worry ourselves about how are we going to, you know, convince enough people to make a revolution, but it's about what we can do right now to begin laying the foundations, to spread and build the strength of left-wing ideas in society. So I guess one of the most frustrating things and disgusting things about Australian society is the way in which the flow of information is censored, you know, obstructed and biased. For example, The Australian constantly publishes articles, you know, denying climate change. Andrew Boll gets a platform week in, week out. Children Overboard, you know, where refugees were blamed for jumping into the ocean where they've been asked to do so by the AFP. This kind of stuff happens all the time. And we all remember, you know, all the weapons of mass destruction that Saddam was hiding back in 2003. Now, socialists, we understand the reason these kind of lies are so common in the media is because the people who own and control it, people like Rupert Murdoch, Kerry Packer, or is it James Packer now, whatever, they're all the same to me, these people are more interested in maintaining their power and indoctrinating the rest of us than actually reporting the news. And this comes again from their class position. So one of the things that we do is put out an alternative media source to counter the spin and provide, you know, real information about what's going on in the world. And to do this, we have a website, we have a monthly magazine, which is not here, unfortunately, and things like that, to explain what's going on. And we also hand out thousands of leaflets on the streets, people passing by, encourage them to learn about left-wing events that are happening in the world and to take a stand. There we go. Our fortnightly meetings and conferences are also a chance for people who are interested in left-wing ideas to get together and discuss what's going on, to debate out tactics and strategies for changing the world. And it's not just lies in the news that need to be debunked, you know. We've been discussing this weekend things like the Russian Revolution. These massive historical events are constantly slandered in universities and schools. You know, there are libraries dedicated to spreading things like this, that, you know, Lenin led to Stalin, that Australia is a tolerant society, you know, that Hitler was supported by the mass of the German people, all these kind of things. You know, just last week, actually, in my politics class, the lecturer was describing, you know, the system of public goods that arises when there's one superpower in the world economy, which is America today. And one of these things was described that America provides is peace. You know, like, it's insane. So we have our own conferences, our own schools, our own books to counter this kind of crap and explain what's actually going on. But at the same time, we're not just some revolutionary book club, you know. We don't just sit here and talk, read, discussing. We're involved in, you know, every campaign, almost every campaign that's happening throughout society, fighting for progressive causes. From refugee rights, you know, to Palestinian rights, to same-sex marriage, climate change, war, and so on. And just in the last 2 months, we've been centrally involved in building two demonstrations in Melbourne and others across the country around the issues of same-sex marriage rights and Palestine. And I guess I wanted to draw this point out a little because what did each of you do last January when 1,400 people were being slaughtered in Gaza? Maybe you went to a protest. You know, maybe you did. That's great. What did you do when the bombs stopped falling? What did you do when the Australian government continued to stand up and support Israel's siege on the Gaza Strip? Did you, you know, put up posters around the city trying to educate people on the issue and mobilise them to build a solidarity movement here in Australia? Were you petitioning 7 days a week trying to get people to take a stand right here, right now? I guess you probably weren't. Not because, you know, you're bad, you're right-wing people, you're apathetic, but because as individuals, we find it difficult to do these kind of things that can make an impact on society. And that's what Socialist Alternative can provide. Not because we're activists, but because we're a network of activists. People who are committed to responding to events in the world and acting to the streets and bring involved new people the ways that single individuals cannot. And because of our politics, we, more than anyone else, actually can take these campaigns as far as they can possibly go. You know, we don't settle for friendly negotiations with the boss. We don't settle for, you know, thinking about the needs of the economy or anything like that. We are even asking for equality. We do not know that what we need to do is fight for our equality. So I guess one of the largest campaigns in recent years, which I think exemplifies this process, is the campaign for refugee rights. There were many people in this campaign who sort of thought that, you know, we shouldn't be too radical, we should appeal to people's humanity, you know, or the humanity of the ruling class more accurately, and so we should only argue that children should be released from detention, or that maybe a short period of quarantining was okay, was appropriate for security reasons. Well, we never accepted this crap. This is racism. We rejected it, and we demanded the immediate freedom of all the refugees from the detention centres. And what's more, when this didn't happen, we weren't happy organising, you know, candlelight vigils, moaning about the situation. But I don't know if you've seen how we organised busloads of people to go to Woomera and tear down the fences. So we're the group that argues for more rallies, more occupations, more confrontations, more often. And we do so, not just because we're revolutionaries and we enjoy holding up the traffic, but because we understand that we live in liberal democracy, which is no democracy at all. That the people who run this country, the politicians and corporate hacks, don't listen to us except when they're forced to. And this is true regardless of which party is running the show. And while few people really look to the ALP these days as for radical change, it is worth talking about the Greens, because they still have some of their radical gloss, I think. It's worth examining this kind of this organisation and really seeing what they stand for. For one thing, they regularly direct their electoral preferences towards the Liberal Party in elections, which is shameful enough. But recently in Tasmania, they've actually been, you know, explicitly going to both parties, Labor and Liberal, and saying, hey, we'll form government with you. We don't mind who. And actually, in polls done, the majority of Greens members and supporters in Tasmania would prefer to go with the Liberals. So that's what this party is educating their members. You know, conversely, the Greens do agree happily that climate change is real. But yet they think that workers and the poor are the ones who should pay via regressive carbon tax. The carbon tax totally indistinguishable from the regressive and hated GST that John Howard introduced. And they oppose the war in Afghanistan, but they do so not because, you know, they're anti-imperialist, anti-war kind of radicals, but because they think Australian soldiers should be killing people in our neighbourhood. You know, they supported the war in East Timor, John Howard's invasion of that country, and they continue to do so. But I guess in dealing with the Greens, it's not just what they say that matters, but also what they do, I think, because as a rhetorically leftist party, they often do have positions on paper that are reasonable, you know, like the war, like on Palestine, refugees, nuclear disarmament, and so on. Disgracefully, though, they never really translate these opinions into action, I think, into real action that matters, action on the streets. Like, how many of you who've been to protests in the past few years have seen more than a handful of Greens triangles at any rally that wasn't a climate change rally? And there's nothing against climate change, but a left-wing party should be more than that. They don't do any of these things. Why? Because as a parliamentary party, the Greens think the main game is in Canberra. They think the actions of workers, students, the oppressed, this is all a diversion, really. Sometimes good leverage, sometimes a distraction. And in fact, their desire to be respectable even holds things back. For example, when asked to advertise pro-Palestine events last year, they refused systematically across Victoria and I think across Australia as well. This is because the Palestinian issue is too controversial. They might lose votes from all right-wing sectors of society. Well, in contrast, Socialist Alternative is not interested in being respectable. We don't care about getting votes from pro-war dickheads. We're not interested in forming governments with the Labor or the Liberal Party, certainly. No, we think the working class, ordinary people, have the power to change the world. And that we think campaigns should link up with workers in their organised form via the trade unions. And this strategy is not something concocted out of thin air. It's not something that we just woke up one day and thought, you know, I think workers are morally better. But it's because this strategy has been tried and tested throughout history. You know, it's no coincidence that the 1960s, the most radical period, in Western societies in many ways, was all, you know, the flowering of women's liberation, of gay liberation, of green bands, pink bands for the first time in the trade union movement. All these kind of struggles against oppression were built up on the, you know, very solid foundations of strong working class consciences, of years of increased union organisation, of increased strikes, and a high level of trade union activity generally. And more radically, I guess, because, you know, we're revolutionaries, the 1960s were great, but they didn't quite, you know, we're still living in capitalism today. In Russia in 1917, the workers that took power instituted reforms that really we're still dreaming about today. Things like as basic as same-sex marriage rights, the end to discrimination against people who might want to sleep with someone of the opposite sex, the end to national oppression, the end to the fact that, you know, as Australians, we have the right to tell the Solomon Island people what to do. Well, in Russia, they allowed every single nation involved in that federation, or that empire really, to secede, to have national self-determination, and so on. They also granted free and legal abortion for the first time in human history. They collectivized, you know, all the shit that today under capitalism mostly women have to do, like housework, childcare, and so on. And they ended the First World War, really, their greatest achievement, I think. So, a war that killed 55 million people, ended by revolutionaries. Which really brings us to the point that I started with, that to achieve the kind of world where justice is a given, we need to overthrow the economic and political structures that are capitalism. You know, but clearly we're not at that level just yet, I guess. You know, some of you might argue, and rightfully so. But I would say there's still no more urgent task than building a group of people, of revolutionaries, of socialists in the here and now. Now this can seem a bit removed from reality, given, you know, I've said the political situation is not quite what it was in the 60s. But I guess there's two facts from history that I think point to the urgency of this task in both the positive and the negative directions. Firstly, revolutions, as I said earlier, are not made by revolutionaries. They happen in a crisis of capitalism. And unfortunately, it's hard to know when a bank will fail or when some ruling class prick will decide to launch a new war. We can't predict these things, but we do know that they happen, and they happen because the competitive way that capitalism is organised. So we need to be prepared, because revolutions are actually inevitable. Their success, however, is not. This is how Marx often misunderstood. He said revolutions are inevitable, but their success is not. So throughout history, precisely because revolutions are spontaneous kind of actions of the oppressed and of the working class, they often fail. Why? Because there are not people who have prepared, who have thought about the problems faced by the revolution beforehand. They've not developed the political clarity, the historical knowledge, and really, what's often left out, the organisational strength to be able to convince people everywhere across society that of a certain strategy and tactic, not to compromise, not to give in halfway, but to take power. This is what happened in Russia, but sadly, every other workers' revolution was defeated. Because this organisation, this revolutionary party, did not exist. You know, from Germany in 1918, 1921, 1923, Spain in 36, Chile 73, Iran 79, Argentina 2001, South Africa in the 80s. All these things have failed, not because the workers weren't fighting hard enough, not because there weren't enough people on the streets, not because there weren't enough strikes, but because the leadership had the wrong ideas. So we need to learn from these ideas, learn from these mistakes. So these tragedies, you know, the millions of workers that have died, and that's what the red flag is all about, the blood of the workers who've struggled for liberation. So these people are not get killed again. Now, for those of you feeling like it's an awfully big task, let's get some perspective, you know. Revolutionaries have always been in a minority. And in Russia, you know, the famous Bolshevik Party, what's often left out of the story is that in the 1880s, they were a pretty pathetic group of five people in Switzerland. You know, five Russians who weren't allowed in Russia. And after 10 years of organising, they were still a pretty pathetic group of five people in Russia. Five people in Switzerland, not having grown at all. After 10 years. Now, obviously, the political framework and the clarity these people developed laid the basis for the growth and the revolution, the successful revolution that was to come. But they were building an organisation in a situation far worse than us today. It wasn't that people were apathetic. It was that police were storming their meetings, beating them up, locking them in jail. Most of these people spent much of their time in prisons. But none of this deterred them. They organised and they persevered. And, you know, the subsequent success of the revolution, I think, is a lesson to us all. So I guess, you know, to sum up, you came here wanting to know about socialist alternative. Well, here's, you know, 3 points you can put on a fridge magnet. I guess, in a world where despair and apathy reign supreme, where people would rather talk about celebrities and sitcoms than get organised, we're a group of people that want to buck the trend and care about the world and want to take a stand right here, right now. In a world where things like racism, sexism, homophobia and so on are everywhere, we're an organisation that stands up against nationalism to defend refugees, to demand equality and to argue the solidarity between all oppressed groups. And in a world where we're taught to accept half measures, compromises, you know, that we should just accept what we've got, that unions should compromise not to endanger the economy and so on. We're an organisation that says, fuck all that, workers and the poor should have it all. Thank you.